Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. The focus for today's show is the hijacked brain, addiction, and recovery. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA, 8.2% of the general population age 12 and over were classified with substance dependence or abuse in the past year. In Alaska, the number for alcohol problems alone is an astounding 14% of the population. Addiction is a significant factor in suicide, homicide, accidental death, domestic violence, and criminal behavior. Addiction also accounts for millions of dollars in lost productivity and is a leading cause of many serious physical and mental health problems. Perhaps the most baffling part of addictive disorders is that only about 11% of people who suffer from them seek treatment in any given year. Another big barrier to treatment is the stigma associated with addiction and the view that those who suffer from it are weak or somehow morally corrupt. The reality is that more than half of all adults have a family history of alcoholism or probably problem drinking, and that approximately 1 in 10 children have at least one parent at home who struggles with addiction. It's my hope that today's show will help shed some light on the fact that addiction is a serious but treatable condition that affects us all at some level and the majority of us in a very direct and personal way. I hope you'll stay tuned for the next hour as my guests and I discuss this complex issue of addiction and recovery. Joining me today are Allison King from Wisdom Traditions and Teresa Williams from Counseling Solutions of Alaska. Allison received her nursing training in Anchorage and worked as a psychiatric nurse for 2 years before joining the U.S. Navy, where she was trained as an alcoholism treatment specialist. From 2001 to 2013, Allison worked as an addictions counselor at Providence Medical Center's Breakthrough Treatment Program. Allison is currently in private practice at Wisdom Traditions, where she conducts individual and group therapy focused on addiction, stress management, and relationship issues. In her personal time, Allison is a talented artist and musician who I saw play at the Hard Rock Cafe last week, which was a lot of fun. Teresa Williams has her master's degree in rehabilitation counseling from Southern Illinois University with a specialization in the treatment of alcohol and drug abuse. She's a licensed professional counselor and is a certified chemical dependency counselor at the advanced level. Teresa has been working in the field of addiction and mental health treatment since 1983 and is currently in private practice at Counseling Solutions of Alaska. Thanks to you both for joining me today.
Thanks for
asking.
Thank
you, Prentice.
I need to take just a moment to remind our listeners how we can be reached. You can call us locally at our phone number 550-8433, or if you're outside of the Anchorage area, you can reach us on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. Please don't hesitate to call in or email us your thoughts. Your calls always make for a better show, so please call in if you got some questions for our guests. Let me take a minute. I didn't get too much into what you guys have been doing for the last many, many years in addiction, but if you could just take a couple of seconds to let our listeners know what you do or what you've done in the past and why you like this line of work. We can start with you, Allison.
Sure. When I got out of nursing school, I worked, as you said, I worked as a psych nurse for a couple of years, and I enjoyed the work to a degree, but I felt like it was, it kept me very, very distant and very detached from the patients that I worked with. And when I started working in the field of substance abuse, what I found was I could have a much more real, personal, honest, upfront relationship with my clients and or patients, depending on the setting. And that was really attractive to me. And plus, I got to watch miracles on a regular basis. And I love watching people sort of catch fire with recovery and turning their lives around and making things so much better for them and their families. And it's just exciting. And you're never bored in this field.
Yeah, it's if you're dealing with somebody that's got a lot of problems and you're not dealing with the root, you're trying to deal with the depression or the anxiety and substance abuse is the underlying issue, as you said, you're not getting very far very fast, are you?
Not very fast or at all.
All right. Teresa, your background, a little bit about what you've been doing and why you do what you do.
Well, I first got into the field working in an adolescent residential treatment program in Florida called Operation PAR, and it's no accident how some of us end up in the field of addiction treatment. I didn't know it at the time, but my own family had been suffering from addiction, and you come to realize this through getting into work sometimes. And so I was there for 3 years and then went on to my master's. But I've worked in a variety of settings, ranging from outpatient, halfway, residential. I worked at a methadone clinic in Chicago during the AIDS crisis in the 80s to early 90s. That was an education. And so I've worked basically every setting. I managed programs in Southern Illinois before coming to Alaska, where I came to work for the Army Substance Abuse Program. While that job wasn't a good fit for me, it, you know, helped me work with the military population, which I had worked also in Germany for a couple years with adolescents working in the ASAC program over there, which is for dependents of military kids. So this profession actually grew me up and helped me come to terms with, you know, my family of origin, and I'm very passionate about what I do, and I believe in recovery strongly. And like Allison talked about, you get to experience, be on the journey of helping people transform their lives, and that's amazing work.
Mm-hmm. All right. Real briefly, Allison, I understand you're involved in a collaborative project. Substance abuse is a major problem in rural Alaska, and that is not the topic of today's show, although it's probably a whole show, or it is probably a whole show or two.
I would think.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on there, just a brief synopsis of it?
Yeah, I'm part of what's called the Bristol Bay Wellness Project, and I've been going out. There are four or five of us that are rotating through the villages one at a time, and I go out for 4 or 5 days at a time, maybe a week. And we work with the population out there. In fact, it's really interesting when you were talking earlier about that it's perceived as a stigma, a moral corruption kind of thing. When I was first out there, the project manager was telling people they were going to set up appointments for the drug counselor. Nobody wanted to come see me. So I'm now just one of the counselors.
Right.
But I end up talking to people because there's so much addiction and alcoholism, and just in the high school kids out there using a lot of drugs, and it's really there's a lot of pain out there, and yet there's a lot of defending their right to continue living the way they live. So I believe that we've made some good progress. We've had a lot of people sort of relax and be able to talk to us and share their pain. We've started a couple of AA and Al-Anon meetings out there. There's somebody out there full time who also is working on an Overeaters Anonymous meeting out there. So, I mean, there's some slow progress, but they don't have a lot else to do unless it's fishing season. That's a lot of work to be done.
Okay. Let's start off with kind of defining the problem of what we're talking about. When we talk about addiction, it's a big old blanket. We could do a show on many different aspects of addiction, and today we're going to kind of do a blanket thing. So when we're talking about addiction, what defines addiction? What makes a process an addictive process? We can start off, Teresa.
Well, first, I really think it's important to understand addiction as a brain disease. It basically, the use of substances, and I'm going to confine my comments to substance use, and, you know, basically causes damage to the circuitry of the brain, especially damage to areas about memory and focus and reward and, you know, motivation, those particular circuits. And really the result of addiction is both psychological, physical, spiritual, social damage. And, the characteristics of addiction are, you know, inability to abstain or control their use, craving. And the most important thing, I think, is diminished recognition of one's the impact of their behavior on their lives. And they choose these behaviors over other kind of natural rewards. And I think that that's the hallmark of addiction, is that the inability to begin making rational choices.
A really good definition that I read from the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence was, a person becomes a substance abuser when the substance becomes so crucial that he or she is willing to risk other important aspects of life in order to have the substance.
Right. And, you know, and at some point it isn't a choice anymore. You know, they may think that they're making choices, but the problem is that the tolerance, the craving, the denial, the need, when you were talking about the reward system, Teresa, that kind of thing, it's so overpowering that they will find ways to justify and rationalize those behaviors, because that becomes, and you could ask a parent of a young child, what's more important, your drug of choice or your child's life? Oh, well, my child's life.
Of course.
And 5 minutes later, they're maybe shooting heroin, or they've bought another half pint of vodka, or, you know, whatever it is. And they will not see, you know, not only the impact on their own lives, but the impact on the lives of others.
Now, isn't addiction really a dissociative experience? And don't we all at some, or most people at some level, experience some sort of dissociative or addictive process, be it, and I do want to do a show at some point on behavioral and process addiction, but Allison, could you speak briefly about other addictive processes and that dissociative experience?
Sure. What I'd like you to do first for the audience is define dissociative, because not everybody's going to maybe understand what you mean by that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I did a show on it a couple months ago, and dissociative experience is sort of what I named the show as checking out, like avoiding the thoughts that are going on in your mind, a way of experiencing something outside that takes you outside yourself. It's an avoidance practice, essentially.
Right. So there are, you know, I know a lot of people are familiar with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, you know, people understand or maybe have heard the term 12-step recovery. And what they now have worldwide is a number of 12-step recovery programs that are about process addictions. There's Overeaters Anonymous, there's Gamblers Anonymous, there's Shopaholics Anonymous, there's Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. So there are a lot of people who find that they get the same addictive kind of cycle going without chemicals. But one of the things that Teresa had mentioned was the reward center in the brain. Mm-hmm. And so when that part of the brain gets activated and there's, you know, those receptors get the neurotransmitters firing in just the right way, that becomes an overwhelming, you know, if I'm going to make a choice to pay my rent or go and buy, you know, 25 pairs of shoes, I might end up buying 25 pairs of shoes.
That's the choosing something over, despite negative consequences.
Right, because there's a sort of a biological feedback cycle that happens, whether it's a chemical substance or not, because the chemicals in the brain still fire.
It's still, somebody described rage as doing that for them, that they, a client I had, that when he gets angry, it's just this intense surge of adrenaline and passion and intensity, and then a crash afterwards.
Right. And they'll even trigger an argument or a confrontation of some kind to get that reward.
To get that reward. All right. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guests today are Allison King from Wisdom Traditions and Teresa Williams from Counseling Solutions of Alaska. Our topic is the hijacked brain, addiction, and recovery. You can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number, 550-8433. Or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, is there such a thing as an addictive personality? Is that, you hear that all the time. Somebody's got an addictive personality. And is that a real thing?
I like to look at this in terms of vulnerabilities versus personality, because I think that that's really what the story is that there's developmental, there's sociological, there are physical vulnerabilities that contribute to addiction. And if you grow up in an alcoholic home, if you have a mental health disorder, if you have chronic pain, if you live in an impoverished area, that creates vulnerabilities for the person. And obviously, once you become, you know, we're going to talk about cross-addiction at another point, but once you become habituated to whether it's a behavior or a substance, you are then more vulnerable to other substances and other potentially addictive behaviors once you get that reward system, you know, those circuits grooved into your brain.
Yeah, and for me, you know, personality is about who I am. And
right.
I am not my addictions.
Right.
You know, so my personality is a whole set of qualities that define who I am at my core. My addictions can start looking like a personality, you know. But the truth is, I can work through those and past those, heal from them. And Teresa was talking about becoming habituated. I can develop new healthy habits of behavior. So I also agree. I wouldn't call it addictive personality. I kind of like cringe at that phrase.
Yeah, that defines the whole person.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, I have a diabetic personality. I have a heart disease personality, right?
Right.
I mean, we're talking about a disease process that can go into remission with proper treatment.
So it's not like a borderline personality disorder.
Correct.
It's not a personality disorder.
No.
So,
no.
Yeah, we shouldn't define it that way.
I try to not do that term at all.
All right. Good feedback. So children of alcoholics and addicts are at a significantly higher risk for developing substance abuse problems. I've heard a lot, and the research indicates that there's a genetic component to addiction. It does seem to run in families. You can chase it back, and if I look at my clients, they have multiple generations sometimes, or uncles and aunts. Is it more genetic environment, the old nature versus nurture debate, or is it a combination of those things?
Combination. It's, you know, they've done enough studies with adopted kids, for instance, who come from an alcoholic family mm-hmm. background, but they're adopted into a family that does not have that going on, and then they still grow up and become addicted to something. So there's that piece. They have identified one gene, I believe, for alcoholism. And there are plenty of people who grow up in an alcoholic family system who do not become addicts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you take a look at genetics, and, you know, there's like four offspring of one combination, there's going to be four different kinds of combinations of that. So environment has a lot to do with it, but so does predisposition on a biological level. It's social and peer stuff, too.
All right. I want to just break away from our conversation for a quick second and go to the phones. We have a caller. Caroline, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I have a question at the end, but I wanted to compliment you on the idea of other addictions. I know that spending is an addiction. I have to watch that myself. And workaholics,
yeah.
Which, you know, years ago I fell into that too because it was so important to get things done. But the question that I had, let me mention this other thing. Years ago, the company for which I worked had funding into a program in the early 80s in Nome, and this was working with alcoholics, and they had a carving program available.
Mm.
And of course, the men were the carvers. And during the 2 weeks that these materials were made available to them until all the stone was gone, these men did not drink at all.
Nice.
And so that's the kind of thing that obviously another study I heard during the time that the nurses department here had they had an alcohol drug abuse conference. That's what it was. And the last speaker that they had, because they closed it down, came in from Washington, D.C., and he said that the latest reports that he had read had to do with not just the women in utero, the babes, but the men, if they were alcoholics up to a year, roughly a year before the child was conceived, the child had a 1 in 4 chance of becoming alcoholic. So that's something that I haven't. But my question has to do with whether or not I've heard that Alaskan Natives and Japanese and other groups do not have biology that everyone else seems to have and absorb alcohol more readily.
Allison?
Yeah, there actually are some studies that various ethnic groups have a higher or lower tendency to have problems. Actually, northern tier Scandinavian countries and the northern tier countries Russia, some of that, the Slavic races, there's a higher percentage than in the Mediterranean countries. So there is some kind of component. Native Americans have an allergy, generally speaking. Asians actually have had a low history of alcoholism until Western culture became more prevalent. And then, you know, apparently you can overcome anything. I've heard people talk about drinking on antabuse and just powering through it until it wasn't a problem anymore. So, again, there's the nature versus nurture thing. I think that, you know, in the alcoholism, Alcoholics Anonymous program, they talk about that it's a physical allergy. So there are a couple different ways that people will respond on that level. But, yeah, there are definite ethnic components to this.
I want to just say some things about the genetic thing. One of the things that we really know about genes from what research is telling us is that oftentimes they exist as vulnerabilities, but there has to be something that kind of turns them on. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about our Native communities as well as you know, other areas of inner city poverty and whatnot is when you combine the elements of poverty, parental alcoholism, domestic violence, trauma, those different kinds of things together, that's when vulnerability rates really go up. And I think that that speaks to some of what's happened to Native communities is that disengagement from their culture and then some generations of these kinds of things happening, living in poverty, living with trauma, sexual abuse, physical abuse. Those things are what creates more vulnerability than genetics alone.
Well, and bringing up the carving in Nome, there's also a spiritual component to addiction and recovery that, you know, if I don't feel fulfilled in my life, if I don't have good skills, if I don't have good stress management, if I don't have a way to channel my creativity, if I don't have something I'm passionate about, alcohol looks pretty tempting and compelling, and that fills that place that feels so empty for so many people. Getting engaged in a passion and in something that's really fulfilling does make a huge difference.
Thank you, Caroline. You bring up a really good point. I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Yes, cultural, historical trauma. I had a great training, and I can't remember the presenters. It was a lady from Bethel, I believe, and she did a great training on historical and cultural trauma, people being displaced from their cultural histories, and that reconnecting with that has a huge impact on addiction and recovery, huge impact.
Yes.
So we want to be careful not to just say there's a whole group of people that, mm-hmm. that can't handle it. It's way more complex than that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things I want to get to really quickly is the early use of alcohol and drugs. We've talked a lot about environment and genetics, but a stat from SAMHSA that I really wanted to point out is that the use before of the age of 14 makes the likelihood of folks developing a substance abuse problem as adults at 14.8% of those people who start before the age of 14 will develop an adult substance abuse problem, compared to 2.3% who use at 21 or older.
Yes.
That's a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that a little bit, Teresa?
Well, this goes back to brain development and brain science, and our brains are developing very rapidly, especially the prefrontal cortex and during adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're using chemicals and abusing chemicals during that point in time, you are basically creating damage to areas that are supposed to be developing, and to put it very simply. And these areas are responsible for reasoning, priority setting, impulse control, learning. and then you're learning all kinds of skills during adolescence about relationships and honesty and learning how to be yourself. And if you're medicating or self-medicating with substances or using substances during that period of time, you're not engaging in that learning. So basically, you have these developmental deficits by the time you get into adulthood, if your addiction doesn't continue. And if your addiction continues, you have further developmental deficits.
And anecdotally, too, in different recovery programs, they talk about how the age you are when you start using chemicals is the age you are emotionally until you get into a recovery process. So there are a bunch of, you know, again, anecdotally, a bunch of maybe 40, 50-year-old people wandering around the planet who are 14 and 15 years old in terms of how they relate to their their world.
So. We all know that guy.
Yeah, we do.
Right? Who's out there, like, just
yeah.
living it up, and yeah. like you see him, and he's like, "Wow, that guy's about 16, but he's really 35."
Right, and the brain doesn't even stop developing until between 21 and 23. Mm-hmm. So we just cut off all of that developmental process neurologically.
Yeah, I've actually heard the frontal lobes in recent research is that it's 25 and mm-hmm. later. There's this later brain development, the frontal mm-hmm. lobe, which is responsible for all those higher mm-hmm. higher functioning things. So that should scare parents a little bit. And since a lot of what I do is adolescent mental health, I'd like for you guys to speak real briefly about what should parents do when their kids are experimenting with alcohol, drugs. We all knew those parents that let their kids use at home. I would rather have them drink at home, and they're not out. But is zero tolerance, which I got three kids, and that's how I'm going to roll with it. Is zero tolerance the best model, or is there some merit to, you know, letting your kids experiment a little bit, because they're going to do it? And there's a difference between experimentation and drug abuse, obviously.
Yeah, I'm one of intervene early. If we lived in a different culture than the one we have now, maybe in a foreign country in Europe where you have some wine with meals, I think it would be really different. But in our culture, substance abuse is unfortunately a rite of passage. And by the time you're in 12th grade, almost 40% of 12th graders have used alcohol in the last year, and about 35% of 12th graders have used marijuana. That's a large swath, if you think about that. And so I really think that parents just need to have open conversations and to not, put their heads in the sand about things, and to, listen, not dictate to their children, but listen to their children and let their viewpoints be known. And share information about genetic vulnerability if it's in your family, because it mm-hmm. sure is in a lot of families.
Right.
And share information about their expectations and why. And I know some parents have difficulty because they actually grew up and may have used marijuana and other substances, and it didn't catch them up, or it didn't cause them problems, and they feel like, well, my kid will get through it. But at the same time, there's so many different vulnerabilities that you have to speak about. What if your kid is a shy kid? Then they're going to be more drawn to using in order to feel more sociable. So that may create more vulnerability for them. So I really think you have to take into account individual characteristics and not just think about your own experience.
I was having the same conversation with somebody the other day about that, I would rather have my children drink with me at home than, and my argument for that is, but you're intervening on their neurological development, you're giving them permission, mm-hmm. you're making it okay, it's illegal, So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff involved, and I would much rather have my children be angry with me, and I'm not a parent. I frankly honor anyone who's courageous enough to have children. I don't want to contribute to the possibilities of what might happen later. So if I were to have kids, I would be saying, you don't get it from me. You don't get to do it around me. But I also like what Teresa's talking about in terms of the education. And I've actually considered writing some children's books that sort of give that education in an easy to swallow way. I just am busy that day, so haven't gotten around to it.
That's a great idea. I appreciate that, and I do think parents need to take it seriously and not blow it off and not just pretend like, oh, it's just something they're going through, because
it's not harmless.
Yeah.
Right. It is not harmless. So before we get to our break, if I got an email here that says, if you had an unlimited budget to address mental health issues, and I assume substance abuse is part of that, in Alaska, what would you ask for?
More detox, rehab, and funding for programs. We are underfunded, and there are waiting lists here, and there should be way better access to treatment than there is. We have one detox center, Ernie Turner Center.
There's only like 8 beds, I think.
8 beds, yes. That's
wow.
Insane. And what we're doing is we're taxing our emergency rooms, and if Providence and Regional were here, we're on our show today, they would be talking about this with us.
Mm-hmm.
That we're doing it, the most expensive option, and costing the taxpayers and the state more money in the way that we do it now. So I'm very, very passionate about that.
Oh, yeah. And I can only ditto that. I mean, those are the best options. And if we had unlimited resources, we would have unlimited resources. Mm-hmm. It would be awesome.
Yeah, emergency rooms and incarceration are more expensive than treatment.
Well, they are, and they don't address the issue.
Yeah.
And incarceration, most people that are in the correctional facilities have a drug or alcohol-related crime.
It's a huge percentage. I don't have the statistics, but I know it's super high.
It's
really, really high.
Yeah.
Okay, we are at the halfway point of our show, so let's go ahead and take a short break. You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. Today's show is The Hijacked Mind, Recovery and Addiction. If you have questions for our guests, you can reach us at 550-8433 or call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. You can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with my guests, Teresa Williams and Allison King. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guests today are local therapists Allison Traditions and Teresa Williams from Counseling Solutions of Alaska. Our topic today is the hijacked brain, addiction, and recovery. As always, you can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org, and you can call us on a local number at 550-8433. And we can be reached toll-free outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Monday night, you'll be hearing a tape recording, and we will not be accepting phone calls. All right. I'd like to get right into I would like to ditto what they said. The question was for all three of us, so I will also agree that I think additional treatment and detox is one of the biggest things I hear. I have a lot of clients who are struggling with heroin addiction in particular right now, and they are 3-4 months away from getting into a treatment program, and that is absurd. When they want it, they need it, and we should be providing that. So that would be my choice as well. So is there a difference? We're talking a lot about addiction. Is there a difference? And I hear this all the time, a heroin addict or somebody who uses meth who now just drinks or just smokes marijuana, and they say, I've been sober for, 12 months now. And I'm like, really? Okay. is there a difference? I mean, we have AA and NA, so those two things are separated. Is there a difference just because something is termed alcoholism or drug addiction?
Well, Teresa, I think, said something earlier, and I was talking as well about, like, for instance, process addictions. I think that once your brain is set up to respond to, you were talking about the sort of dissociative thing, it's like, I will do anything it takes to not have my feelings. So if it's chocolate cake or heroin or a new pair of shoes, I will do that unless I develop better skills. So if I stop using one chemical, great. But if I'm still using another one, that part of my brain is still active and I'm still doing the same process. So my personal opinion is addiction is addiction.
Yes.
there are some that are going to kill me faster than others.
Right.
You know, a new pair of shoes probably isn't going to kill me unless I fall off a cliff or something. But, you know, and that's why I think recovery is such an important thing to talk about instead of simply abstinence. Because if all I do is take away my alcohol or my heroin or my gambling or whatever, and I don't replace it with something positive, I'm going to replace it with something addictive because it's a vacuum. Got to fill it with something.
We also basically evaluate the problems the exact same way. We actually don't call it abuse and dependence anymore. The new language is substance use disorder, mild, moderate, severe.
Okay.
But we evaluate a person's use based on the same symptoms, whether it's heroin or whether it's alcohol. And, you know, you're kind of touching on some cross-addiction elements here.
Yeah.
You know, basically the rule of thumb with that is that, you know, central nervous system depressants people are going to be more vulnerable. For instance, heroin addicts are more vulnerable to alcoholism because they're both central nervous system depressants and benzodiazepines and stimulant. People who use methamphetamine are more vulnerable to cocaine addiction. But I have seen clients, and you've seen clients, that gravitate toward just about all of what I'm describing. And a lot of it is that, you know, wanting to relief of some kind, mm-hmm. whether it's from anxiety or self-esteem issues or stress of some kind. And so there are people in the 12-step groups that do the marijuana maintenance plan in which they are abstinent from alcohol or heroin or cocaine, but they still smoke weed because that's never got them in trouble. And I agree with Allison that, you know, I think an abstinence approach is oftentimes leads to the most fuller kinds of recovery because you're no longer self-medicating those same kinds of things, stress, anxiety, mood issues, anger, self-esteem issues with substances, and you then can have more possibility for a fuller, richer, more productive quality of life. And I do think that any use of substances, once you've extinguished your primary substance of abuse, makes you vulnerable to potentially relapsing on your substance of choice.
And that does happen a lot.
All right, so let me ask you a question about nicotine and caffeine then. Those are substances that people abuse in recovery all the time. It's never really talked about or thought of very much, I don't think, although I remember one time I was working at a treatment center and they went smoke-free and the place went from 35 to 2 mm-hmm. overnight. People bailed out like left and right. Like, no way you're taking away my nicotine. But do those lead back to relapse? Or those, if we're talking about recovery mm-hmm. And stopping that brain process, is it important to eliminate these other chemicals as well?
Important, yes. High priority initially, probably not. But
right.
The statistics are, and I don't have the exact numbers, but the relapse rate among smokers is much higher than the relapse rate among non-smokers. And, you know, in the treatment program that I worked in prior when I worked at Breakthrough, we didn't serve caffeinated coffee there. We asked people not to bring in things like, you know, Red Bull or, you know, the energy drinks, those
right.
kinds of things. And basically, if you're going to smoke, you have to go off the property to do that, those sorts of things. If you chew, you still can't do it in here because it's the same. I mean, you know, that kind of stuff. So we encourage people to consider those kinds of apparently less harmful addictions. And the truth is they'll just kill you more slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nicotine is a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, I'm discussing addiction and recovery with my guests, Allison King and Teresa Williams. You can reach us with your questions at 550-8433 or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. So that leads us right into the question of treatment. Now, you guys mentioned some things will kill you faster than others. And in harm reduction, I mean, a heroin addict who is only smoking weed is a lot less, I mean, destructive, self-destructive, and at risk for death much less. So if we're talking about treatment, what are some of the different treatment options? Everybody knows about AA and AA 12-step groups. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other possibilities for treatment?
Well, I know that one of the things that people always say is that AA and NA, some people have problems because they're a spiritually based program. And, right. and while they use the term higher power, many people at meetings will talk about God or Jesus or their higher power of origin. And sometimes that's off-putting to people. And so there are alternative support groups. Smart Recovery is one of them, Women for Sobriety, Secular Organization for Sobriety, just to name a few, Rational Recovery, Moderation Management, which proposes to help people control drinking. So I'm not really a proponent of that. But those are the self-help options, and certainly most good treatment centers will want to expose people to these various options and help a person try to link to one that makes sense for them, because support is so crucial in any kind of behavioral change. Without support, most people can't recover at all. And I'll let Allison talk here a minute before we go on to actual program treatment options.
Yeah, just sort of going back to a previous discussion that we were having, though, is the treatment options in Alaska are severely limited. Mm-hmm. If one has the resources to go outside, there are a number of treatment programs that address, you know, there are places that are women only or gay or Native American or, you know, trauma survivors and addiction. I mean, there's so many options outside, but they're very expensive. Some of them don't even do insurance. You have to pay up front and then get your insurance company to reimburse you. So treatment is really difficult. And unfortunately, the 12-step spiritual piece of that is a lot of people are so put off by that initially that they don't understand that you don't have to believe in God or be of any sort of religious affiliation. And there is actually an Atheists Alcoholics Anonymous spinoff. And there are people in AA, for instance, and other 12-step programs who are Buddhist, and that's not, that's not a God kind of religion, you
right.
know. So I hope that even for people who don't have access to a good treatment program, even if they're willing to explore going to a 12-step process or 12-step program, that they will find a place that they can get those needs met for themselves, that are recovery, that don't insist that they have a specific belief, because that's what people are afraid of, is you're going to make me have to believe in something that I don't want to believe in.
If you just roll in off the street to an AA meeting and you spend an hour sitting in there and you listen to people do the different, you know, chants and hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer and there's a lot of talk about God and mm-hmm. things like that, a lot of people say, I can't handle that.
That's
I can't
true.
Deal with that. And they leave. But I've heard it put that, spirituality, as you guys have talked about, is doesn't have anything to do with Jesus and
Correct.
God necessarily, mm-hmm. unless that's your bent.
Right.
It is about, I mean, it can be the universal power, the energy force, whatever mm-hmm. it is. But it's about connecting with something outside of yourself.
Well, and spirituality... Actually, there's a great quote from William James in his book, 100 or so years ago. I don't even remember when he wrote that, but it was called Varieties of Religious Experience. And he said that spirituality is the attempt to come into harmony with the great mysterious order of things. That's not exactly a direct quote, but it's something like that. It's just an attempt to be in harmony. But spirituality is about honesty. It's about integrity. It's about responsibility. It's about respect. And those are all spiritual principles that have nothing to do with going to church.
It's about balance and harmony and unity. And
Yeah. Moderation.
Moderation.
Yeah, whatever that might mean. So those 12-step programs can fulfill the need, and certainly not all AA meetings pray or say the Lord's Prayer. I mean, there are so many varieties. But I know that at Wisdom Traditions, there is a treatment program, a recovery program, where it's individualized to the extent that the program staff will work with each client where they're at, and some harm reduction is involved and some other modalities are involved. They have yoga and acupuncture. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on there. Providence Breakthrough, while it is 12-step based, it's, you know, they're not going to beat you up if, I mean, right. it's about, here are some resources, check them out. And my approach is, if you don't think it's going to work for you, then do it so that you know whether it will or not. And people say, oh, I hate the 12 steps. It's like, really? What do you know about them? Mm-hmm. So do a scientific experiment for a year. If you right. want to be scientifically oriented, go do the thing and see if it works. But do it. Or whatever else. Moderation management, by the way, doesn't appear to work very well. But.
No.
Yeah, there is a difference between substance abuse and substance dependence, right? I mean, there's a lot of people who abuse alcohol in college or binge drink, and then they sort of outgrow that as they age into adulthood. But that's not what we're talking about here today. If you've established a pattern of drinking or abusing substances to the degree that somebody does, you know, where they're losing mm-hmm. everything, then you probably got that.
Well, and you don't have to lose everything, Prentice.
Right.
You know, one of the things is sometimes people, you know, most of us can spot somebody who's drinking on the street and has messed their pants and looks dirty and disheveled. You know, that's an alcoholic. But really what we're talking about when people cross over to what we now call substance use disorder, moderate or severe, is, you know, there's preoccupation with using over other things that used to be important to them. There's typically tolerance developing. Sometimes withdrawal happens, not always. And there's loss of control that they can't predict once they start, if they can stop, or they have periods of time where they can and then periods of time where they can't.
Mm.
Those are the things, in addition to the mounting consequences that happen. So you don't have to hit rock bottom or lose everything to be addiction. And, you know, for some people with highly addictive substances or frequent use of larger amounts of alcohol can progress really rapidly to some really severe points.
Yeah, those are the easy ones to identify. Mm-hmm. It's the people successful. I've heard somewhere that most alcoholics function really well.
Many.
And that's a barrier to actually getting into treatment and recovery, is that you have money in the comforts of home and mm-hmm. you haven't lost much.
Well, and that's sort of the seductive denial
right.
piece is I used to work in the prison system, and I had a client there who at the age of 47 had been drinking and driving pretty much all of his adult life, had never had a DUI, never been in trouble, never had a problem until he had a head-on collision and killed a family.
And then it all went.
And then it's gone. And you can't predict. And the thing about use or dependence, you know, we were talking earlier at the break about spice and teenagers and experimenting and stuff like that. All it takes is one time for some of these things and, you know, people die.
Tragic life-altering
consequences.
So,
I mean, really, I'm going to try cyanide to see if I get high? It's the same thing. It's, well, here's a piece of poison I think I'll see mm-hmm. if I die or not. So, I don't know.
I want to go real quickly to a caller. We have Sheila. You're on line one.
Hello?
Hello, Sheila. You there?
Yes, I am.
All right.
I would be interested in knowing if anyone there has any experience or backgrounds with people who have suffered from TBIs, traumatic brain injury, and the tendency towards the incidence of alcoholism or drug addiction among those people, because it is my understanding that TBIs can result in long-term, lifelong impacts that, and many people don't even realize when they've had a traumatic brain injury, but a lot That's of correct. Athletes and snowboarders, et cetera, mm-hmm. Have these problems. And I heard that the incidence of alcoholism or addiction among that set can be as high as 60%. Does anybody have any background in that or any comment? And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you for the call, Sheila. That's a great question.
Sure.
Great question. I don't have any statistics or anything to offer, but certainly both Alice and I have worked with people with TBIs. What you're talking about is creating more vulnerability to addiction, not only because of the damage to the brain from the actual traumatic brain injury, but also the social and psychological vulnerabilities that go along with being having your brain injury. So yes, their risk of addiction is greater. And one of the other things that we often see with folks with TBI is that there are sometimes, depending on where that brain damage is tolerance changes, where very small amounts of the substance will have a more profound effect than you anticipate. Mm-hmm. And so, and it can be very challenging depending on, again, the nature of the injury and what kinds of problems that that person has, because memory systems are often impaired with folks with TBI they can't then regulate their behavior and regulate their priorities as easily as somebody without a traumatic brain injury.
And mood regulation as well, impulse yes. control, those kinds of things. And it's interesting because a number of people that I have worked with had their brain injury as a result of their chemical use. Yes. So there's sort of a chicken and egg thing involved here as well, but it's true that even what we used to think of as mild concussion can still have long-term negative impact on people's personality, decision-making, impulse control, those kinds of things. So you're absolutely right. This is another increased vulnerability. And even though this is sort of a side comment, there's another piece that people aren't aware of, that people who have gastric bypass surgery are also at increased risk. In fact, almost everyone that I've worked with who's had a gastric bypass really didn't have a problem with alcohol until afterwards. Hmm. And then it was practically instant severe alcohol dependence because there's no filtering going on. It's just straight into the brain and the blood.
Interesting. So, and they may have vulnerabilities because many of them have
eating disorders.
Eating
yeah.
disorders and processes. Right. All right, we got a lot to cover. There's an email here about clients in dual diagnosis, bipolar, self-medicating with substances. How do you begin the conversation? Like somebody comes in and they have, I'm depressed or I'm anxious or I'm having these mood swings, and it really is paired up with alcoholism and addiction. How do you address that? How do you bring that up?
Sure.
Or PTSD. I mean, that's a huge one.
It's huge.
You always do a comprehensive integrated assessment, and it's very important. These things often go together. And so it's important for people to ask the question and not just, are you using now or in this last year, but get a good history. I think it's really important when I talk to those folks to just really start where they are about what they're willing to begin working on. And because sometimes people are more motivated to work on their depression and less motivated to work on their substance use.
Almost so universally.
So we start where they are, and we weave in and use motivational interviewing approaches in order to enhance motivation for change or help them connect the dots.
Right. And sometimes people will come in and we will not actually work on a diagnostic piece for other co-occurring disorders unless they already have a pre-existing diagnosis, because it's going to take maybe 2 or 3 weeks after they detox before it starts to start to settle out. So somebody could look like they have anxiety or bipolar disorder or severe depression, but eventually that might go away. And I've seen that happen many times. I have someone that I worked with a number of years ago who was in and out of psychiatric hospitals for years, depressed, severe depression, and she hasn't been medicated or hospitalized for years after getting into recovery, and she's not getting depression.
Right.
So, but you also can't work on these issues if you're using drugs and alcohol. So if someone comes in and says, oh, I'm bipolar, it's like, well, great. Let's get you stable on your medication and let's keep you abstinent from chemicals so that you can actually get some stabilization and do the work.
A long time ago, I had a guy that came in and he said, I'm a jerk, I'm angry, and I drink too much, and I don't want it to be about drinking. And I said, okay, well, let's start with the jerk part, and we'll go from there. and he ended up having to give up drinking.
Yeah.
And then the jerk part kind of went away.
Yeah.
So that was remarkable. So want to get quickly to treatment. What if somebody's got a problem or they're concerned or they have a family member? How do they start? Where do they go here locally?
Well, first of all, if there's a family member, I just really encourage positive approaches. I know that intervention is a thing, but I really believe that most people are attracted into change and to dialogue mm-hmm. and not give up on their family member. And there's a book I always recommend that is called Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change by Jeffrey Foote. It uses craft or the positive reinforcement kinds of approaches. So, you know, I think that, and families attending Al-Anon is an excellent resource to help people learn what they can do that helps and doesn't help motivate somebody to change.
Yeah, and intervention is certainly one option, and there is an intervention helpline here in Anchorage. I don't have the number, but we could Google it.
Is it through Providence?
No, it's a separate it's a separate thing called Intervention Helpline.
Cool.
But I don't have it with me, I'm afraid. And I agree that, you know, having the dialogue, and it depends on the person. You know, it depends on the family system. It depends on the person who's in trouble. But getting someone interested in treatment is an enormous task. Unless they're asking for it, generally speaking, if you say, I think you got a problem, there's not a lot of friendly response to that. Mm-hmm. But if someone actually is interested, there are a number of places they can go for assessments.
Okay.
And Providence Breakthrough is one. Wisdom Recovery is one. Clitheroe, Salvation Army Clitheroe is one.
Akila.
I don't know if Nugent's does assessments. I'm sure they must, but they're out in the valley and they have a great program. And there's lots of different programs available that work for different populations or different individuals. The biggest problem, like we were talking earlier, is getting into one.
Yeah,
the waiting. So we need more resources in our community.
And residential treatment is not happening here. There's like Nugent's and Clitheroe, and that's about it. Genesis as well. Akila, true.
Yes. As well as Dina Coy, Ernie Turner Center.
Some of which you have to be eligible for.
Right.
We are up against our deadline, and I'd like for each of you to take just a second and give us one thing that you want people to take away from this show. We can start with you, Allison. One thing that you want people to remember.
I'm going to try really fast to throw a couple in there. There is a film called The Anonymous People that I recommend. It's available on Netflix. You can buy it on Amazon. It's an amazing film. It's done recently, and it gives a lovely overview about addiction and recovery and social impact, but also from the perspective of it being, you know, there may be 20 million people in the United States who are addicted, and there are 23 or some million people in recovery that are active and help be happy and healthy and enjoying life. It's a really powerful film, and I think it decreases some of the negative feelings about it. There's a book called,
Teresa.
Sorry.
Just want to take people take away hope and that recovery is possible, and don't give up on people. Because you don't know when they're ready to change.
Good.
All right. I want to thank my guests, Allison King and Teresa Williams, for joining me. The presence of dementia is not associated with normal aging. Next week, Dr. Woodard and his guests will explore the most recent understanding of Alzheimer's and other dementias. So why not tune into Your Health and learn more Monday, August 3rd at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.